Welcome to the Business Beyond Performance podcast. That is the amazing looking fresh haircut second baby daddy, Matt Powell. And I am the sweaty, it's way too hot in Connecticut. Why? Joe Staub.
Thanks for the intro, man. I appreciate that. Yeah. Get another week here into dad life, you know, just hanging out. Excited to talk about our guest today, Pat Dixon. Why don't you tell us a little more about him, Joe?
So Pat is a guy, as some of our original guests have been, is a UConn guy at heart. So we both connected with him and have known him in the circle because we're both UConn guys. Former strength coach in the collegiate space, was out in California. Was at UConn, went out to California, came back, worked at St. John's on the men's basketball side for a whole bunch of years. Actually, a really nice write-up on him building his house after Hurricane Sandy kind of leveled his whole area. So if you're not familiar with Pat and you want to see an interesting story of a guy post a natural disaster, Google Pat Dixon building a house, St. John's basketball, Long Island. From there, went back out to California and was an assistant AD, got a big seat at the table. And then from there, transitioned out to now working at AMP Human, and is, I believe, he's had a few titles there over time, but I believe he is the director of sports science or performance science, something like that. I totally butcher it like I always do with these guys. So that's who Pat is in a quick nutshell.
Yeah, so this is actually my first time, this and one other conversation before the show, getting to know him. But I've heard about Pat since 2009, 2008, somewhere around there. And he just continuously finds these amazing jobs, makes connections, always knows everybody. And the coolest thing about Pat is it's not a bravado or an ego or anything like that. He just genuinely wants to meet good people and help them become even better. And he's just a super connector. And he's put us on to other interviews we're going to have later on. And I'm just super excited to talk to him and kind of go through it. How he got to where he is. Cause I think for young strength coaches, athletic trainers, other, you know, fitness professionals, it's really important to see that don't limit yourself or don't box yourself. There's so far you can go in this realm, in this future for sure.
No, definitely. And Pat's also a guy like us who's never stopped learning. So in addition to a master's degree at UConn, that's how he ended up there. Kind of like we did. He also has an MBA. He's always looking at other certifications, whether it's in business, whether it's in performance, whether it's, you know, he's a guy who's always sharpening his sword. And like you, and as you guys will see when you listen to him, and if you watch him on YouTube, he's a personal guy. You know, he can talk, you know, he's like a guy like me. He can talk to the wall and have a good conversation. So, you know, I love the guy. I've been able and been fortunate enough to have him kind of help me and had great conversations with him. You know, over the years, I first talked to him when I was even looking for a job back when I was, you know, undergrad, to now. You know, it's, you know, every couple of months, you know, every month or every other month or so, I'm on a good hour long conversation with him, talking business, talking shop, talking industry, and now also talking family and, you know, talking having a family and all that kind of good stuff. So, no, he's just a good guy all around and someone to really look forward to have to talk. And if you're, again, if you're in the industry in whatever role, athletic training, nutrition, strength conditioning, and you're looking at getting out, but still want to be involved, he's a great guy to talk to about that because much like myself, he's done it. And he's been very successful at it. So without further ado, episode 10, Pat Dixon. Actually just wanted to take a second right now before we start the episode and give a quick shout out to two unofficial sponsors and an official sponsor. First unofficial sponsor, Play. Most comfortable shirt I've ever got at an NSCA or CSCSA conference. That's why I still own it. That's why I still wear it. Their products are great. And most importantly, the director of education, Mike Bewley, is truly a guy, much like Ron McKeever before him, who is actually trying to help push the industry forward. So if you're in the performance space or an athletic trainer or a nutritionist or a mental performance sports psych, if you're anybody working with athletes, find Mike Bewley, find Play. Great products, but better people. Second unofficial sponsor, Stepani Nutrition. So Jim Stepani, we obviously have a couple people from his team. Eventually, one day we'll get Jim. He's a UConn guy, just like Pat, a few others we had. But again, if you don't understand supplements or you're questioning what supplements to go with, go find Stepani and understand why he does what he does, why his supplements are made the way they are. Obviously, listen to when we have Dr. Tim Sheets and Vince Andrich on this podcast because they work at Stepani Nutrition. but obviously, you know, just a great product and something I've used for years and years and years. Last one, the official sponsor, Strive. So as some of you guys know, I at one point consulted with them. So I'm sure there's a conflict of interest in here somewhere because at one point they paid me. I personally think the product is kind of the next evolution of what performance monitoring is supposed to be, because I can track everything you do on the field, in the games, you know, all the external stuff. But if I don't measure how your body did it, it doesn't matter. So for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, go find Strive. It's wearstrive.com. We want to thank them for being an official sponsor. We're actually going to get the CEO, Nicola, on the podcast to talk about his path from being an athlete to being an engineer, to taking jobs specifically to run a business and be a CEO. So again, just a great product and another great group of people. So thanks to Strive for officially sponsoring. And then the other ones. Want to give an unofficial sponsorship shout out to Dr. Jim Stepani, Dr. Tim Sheets, and Vince Andrich, the later of the two who have both already been on the podcast, and JYM Supplement Science. So JYM, kind of like Jim with a J, Supplement Science.
Yeah, absolutely. Great product. Something that we definitely have used quite a bit over the years. Great protein. And the thing that we both really appreciate about them is they actually have research behind everything. Dr. Tim Sheet, as you mentioned, who's been on the podcast before, went through and explained how they actually do the research, unlike most companies in the supplement industry. And they actually give out information that makes sense, and they help people decide what supplements are best for them, even if it doesn't mean they go with their company. But they prove time and time again that science and the research behind it are the reason why these supplements work. And then they give those, you know, powering statements and empowering movements to help these people make the best decisions for them and their individual needs as a consumer.
No, and again, never hurts that they're UConn guys either. but no, definitely JYM Supplement Science. Check them out. Again, it's top quality products with the research to support them. And if it's a brand you're not familiar with, it's something you should be familiar with, either yourself or your athletes.
For sure. Joe, if there is one unofficial sponsor throughout our entire podcast, all the episodes we've done so far, I think we're up to like 15 by now. Who would you choose?
Well, Matt, we're actually up to 19. And the reason I know is because I write it all down in my Rocket Book. Right? So I got the little one right here. I got the full size one on the desk, right? It's something I use every day in my personal and professional life. It's been a tool that the last 2 years since I found it has, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, has changed the way I take notes, has changed the way my crappy handwriting can be digitized into, you know, typed Word documents for ease of use to send in emails and everything. So I would highly recommend, if you don't know what Rocketbook is, check them out, get one, use it for a few months. I guarantee it'll change your life. Hi, welcome everybody to another episode. I'm joined with my beautiful co-host, Matt Powell. And tonight, actually on election night, thank you for joining us, Pat Dixon, former strength coach, multiple stops at multiple places, also famous for rebuilding a house post-hurricane when his time at St. John's. There's a great, was it New York Times article about that?
Yeah, the New York Times, the Daily News, and I think ESPN ran a blurb too.
Nice. So left St. John's working with men's hoops for quite a few years, out to California. One of the guys who I personally drew some insight and development in the profession, because hearing him take that job as an assistant AD, he always referenced having a seat at the table and being in the conversations with ADs and other administrators. And having a seat at the table was a philosophy I took into all my jobs of getting people to understand the importance, but then also having input. And I still use that today in the things I do outside of strength. From there, you know, similar to myself and Matt in a different way, Matt just did his RD recently. Pat, you got an MBA. I have one too. So diversified your skill set, added some tools to the toolbox, and now you are in the private sector of the sport performance, consumer goods space, working for a company named AMP, HP, AMP Human Performance.
AMP Human.
It's just AMP Human. It's the HP is just the human side now?
It's gone. Just AMP Human.
Okay, AMP Human now. So before we get into everything, we go back through some of our connections. So we're all UConn guys. We've all worked for Jerry Martin. We all know Mo Butler. Shout out to Mo Butler. So where do we start? Do we start at the journey? Do we start at the business side? Do we start at you being like us in terms of how you treat people, but also being a hustler in terms of how you always have something cooking and irons in the fire? Where do we go?
You know, I think the best place to start off is just kind of laying groundwork, right? And, you know, our individual philosophies are really the sum of the stops that we've had and our experiences. But one of my core tenets actually goes back to what Jerry Martin told me. And so in between my junior and senior year of undergrad at UConn, I had taken an internship at a university, and it was supposed to be a paid position with housing. And so I drove roughly 8 hours to get there. I'm really excited because I'm about to start working with football players over the summer, and I'm super geeked out about it. And I get in, and the guy proceeds to tell me there's no stipend. So, you know, a little frustrated, right? But then he proceeds to tell me, well, you can get a job at like one of the local restaurants or something like that. You should be and I'm thinking to myself, like, there's no restaurant in the area that's going to hire somebody who comes with a born-on date and an expiration date. Right. So there's no way you're going to pick up a waitering job at Outback for 8 weeks. It's not going to happen. And so I remember calling Jerry up and Coach Martin. And he said, Pat, there's three things to learn from every situation. There's what to do, there's what not to do, and there's how to treat people. And he's like, you made a promise to this person to be there. And he's like, you have to understand that. So what's the value of your word? And so I ended up leaving the position, right? Because I couldn't sustain myself. It wasn't like I had a bunch of money saved up that I could, you know, pay for this thing to happen. But the concept of what to do, what not to do, and how to treat people has really proliferated everything that I do. So whether I was a grad assistant at UConn, whether that was, you know, low assistant at the University of California, the basketball guy at St. John's, an assistant AD at LMU, you always have to remember you can learn what to do, what not to do, and how to treat people in every situation. And I think that's really something that I wish more professionals would kind of take to heart, because a lot of the sticky situations that you might get into as a coach, if you take a step back, right, there's something to be learned there. And some of those opportunities really aren't the lost opportunities or the frustrating situation that they are if you step back and kind of look at it. From that situation. So I think that's something really important to kind of start off with.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the way you broke that down, it sounds like you really know who you are and kind of what your values are and also kind of why you do the things you do. So as you transition from strength and conditioning over into the private sector working with AMP, what were some of the things that you had to kind of change or look at and evaluate as you made that change?
So I think, you know, Joe touched on it a little bit earlier, talking about wanting a seat at the table. And it wasn't an ego thing. It was, in athletics in general, there are so many people that are in the trenches on a daily basis. And what I refer to as the trenches is, you're up at 5 o'clock in the morning to make sure that your weight room's ready to go at 5:30. And when your kids hit the door at 5:45, you're jacked up and you're pumped up, ready to get them going, because you know that you're the thermostat in the room. You set the temperature. You set the tone, right? And to grind out 12-hour days, I love that. I had a ton of fun with it. I got a ton of energy back from my kids. But there aren't enough people in that C-suite at a university or at a pro team or in a business that have a full grasp of what it is to do that grind. And so one of my frustrations was, you know, when you talk about budgeting, right, and your first-year athletic trainer is making $40,000 a year, or your first year at, you know, strength coach is making that with a master's degree, right? Like, how do you support them in their growth, right? Like, $500 to them could be a car payment, could be a flight home for the holidays. But for some other people in the staff, and it doesn't matter what school you're at, that's like a rounding error. It's like, meh, whatever. And so I think really having a greater opportunity to affect change only happens if you educate yourself and put yourself in a position to be able to talk to people and get them to understand, hey, you know, I know we got 10 grand left over at the end of the year and our goal is to have a barbecue for the staff, but how about we give like a one-time bonus to like the 20 lowest paid people in the athletics department, right? Because that $500 is gonna mean a whole lot more to them than a couple of beers, a burger, and like some laughs with some friends. And like, I'm not poo-pooing the situation. Please understand that. It's just, it's understanding that. And so.
So did your assistants got 40,000? I thought that was the head guys. That's what mine was.
No, I mean, so I've always battled for my staff and I put them first because I'm a big believer that if you build a staff and can provide continuity, the success will come. And so when I got to LMU, there have been some turnover in the last couple of years, and my goal was really just to provide balance and some continuity over the years. And I'm very lucky that so Gino Rosario, who was one of my guys there, and Jack McCormick in the first year, Gino stepped away and then went to Irvine. I got another guy there, Jordan Alcantar, who's still there, took over men's basketball for me when I left. They allowed me to have that continuity because when you don't have to worry about your staff, you can actually do your job better, right? And so
amazing how that works,
right? And so, you know, in the first 2 years that I was there, it was really about battling to get them up. And it was also during the time where California went through this upregulation where they said, hey, if you're a full-time non-exempt employee, like there has to be, I think it was either $49,000 or $50,000 was like the bare minimum that you could pay somebody at that point. And it was really important to get them to that level. Because I had been there, right? Like we've all been there. My first job at University of California, Berkeley, 37.5, living in the Bay Area in 2004. Okay. I took BART to work because I couldn't afford the $120 a month to pay for a parking pass on campus. Right. So like I took BART through the Caldecott Tunnel and then I got off at Rock Ridge and I would ride my bike up College Ave in order to make it work. Like you find a way, but
I now rescind my $40,000 joke. I was in Louisiana, not nearly as bad,
but right. You're young and hungry.
Pat, I think Powell offered me a job or considered me for a job one time when he was the director in Louisiana. I think it was an assistant full time for like 22,000.
Consider is a relative term. I think I was just that low on the list at that point for 22,000.
Hey, my entire career, baby. The only reason I got the Hofstra job is because they couldn't hire anyone who they tried to give it to because they couldn't give the job away at that time. Because right. Again, the job was shit. The pay was terrible. Yeah. The structure and the setup wasn't good. I mean, I have, again, shout out to Rocketbook. Always using the Rocketbook. They're Boston based. You know, I got all of them. I had to have conversations with my AD around when we offered someone an assistant job, it has to be 40. It has to have a 4 because if it has a 3, it just looks bad. You know, we're bringing someone to New York City and you're going to put a 3 in their salary as the first number. Get the fuck out of here. Like, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
For us, and I know I cut you off a second there, Pat, but
no, you're good.
The question is, how many things did you have to do to build and develop your staff so they could do their job? But how many things did you have to do to get them additional opportunities so they could survive? You know, for me, I turned down the Columbia job. I interviewed with Tommy and Matt, had an opportunity to work there. When you look at the numbers, and I wrote about it in my book, it made no sense. It was a terrible financial move, though I would have had great mentors. I would have had great people to work with. It was a terrible move to make, so I didn't make it. So how did you try and not only empower them in their day job, but also give them, you know, tools, resources, skills, whatever, so in their extra time, they could try and be more financially functioning?
Sure. So the first thing is, how do you create that value proposition for your administrator, right? And so the administrators, they understand that there are certain positions within every organization that they expect to turn over. Like, it's just expected. It's an entry-level position. It just is what it is. The code is never going to change on that position. So what I did was I ran the math on what it costs to interview and the cost to bring somebody up to speed, right? And the rough math works to, if you bring in 3 candidates, interview them, the rough math works out to between like $7,500 and 10 grand. To interview plus the downtime, right? And so I said, if we can raise salaries to $50,000 in Los Angeles, right? The only way that person is going to leave is if they're getting an associate position or they're going to a Pac-12 school. That's the only way they're going to leave. But if I'm getting nickel and dimed because a guy is making 43 or 44 and he gets a $4,000 raise to go to another like mid-major university, I was like, that's why you're getting turnover. And I was like, you got to put him in a situation where like $4,000 doesn't mean as much to him. Because if that person is then making 50 and they're getting a $4,000 raise, it's like, meh, you know what? My wife really likes where we're living right now. We're comfortable. We've got our friends here. I've got no commute. Versus if they're getting bumped to 60, like then I've done my job as a mentor and they're moving on and they're moving up, right? But I don't want to be in a position where my staff is leaving because they need $3,500 or $4,000 for a raise, right? And I'm not saying that that's no money, but I'm saying like for some people when you're just starting out, that's meaningful. Does that make sense, Joe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And that's even at Hofstra, the two assistants I hired, Emily and Ashley, I specifically told them, you should treat this like a two-year job. There's not a ton of growth. I'm here. The guy behind me is taking over for me. Like, you have to understand this is a get in, get your feet wet, get the experience, and get out and move on to the next step because there was no development, that this role wasn't going anywhere. And Emily took that and ran with it literally to the timeline. Ashley, through a combination of having family and just the things she's been able to develop from, again, her other tools in her toolbox, has now been there coming up on 4 years. But again, she's doing a lot outside of her 9-to-5 job that allows her in. Again, she has family. There's other things for her that make it a reason to stay.
Sure. So I think, right, the next step then becomes how do we teach our staffs to behave? And as strength coaches, how do you present yourself, right? Because when I've walked into weight rooms as I've gone to other universities and audited and wanted to learn and wanted to expose myself, right? You can't tell the difference between the strength coach and one of the athletes. And if I'm a senior AD and I walk in and I can't tell the difference, why am I going to pay that person $80,000 or $90,000 a year if I can't tell between, like, and I'm not knocking style, I'm not knocking culture, but we, as strength coaches, we've got to hold ourselves to a higher standard and set ourselves apart. And so one of the things I did at LMU was I had a no hat rule for my staff and we all wore collared polo shirts. And in the beginning, it kind of was just like, oh man, like, come on, coach. Like, Pat, why are you being that way? And I was like, because if I have a senior vice president from the university show up to the weight room, I want them to know who my staff is. I want them to be able to tell the difference. And I want to be able to brag about that because you do set the tone in the room, right? We, you know, Jerry Martin, right? We tuck our shirts in, okay? Like, being a professional is really important. And what's ironic is that I've had staffs now that have worked for me at a couple of spots. They go to conferences and I'll get a text with like a photo of somebody from behind, like hat backwards, baggy shorts, t-shirt untucked with flip-flops on. And they'll be like, not a professional. And again, style, not knocking it. But as strength coaches in general, what we need to do is we need to understand that the image that we project is as important as the information that we have to share, is as important as our ability to coach the athletes that we work with. And those concepts are really important because if you're a big time football guy and you're attached to a big time coach that's winning all the time, like you can do whatever you want. Like you get a solid pass, right? But if you're trying to grow as a young professional, right, how do you set yourself apart from your peers? Right. And when the AD walks into the room and you're sitting there with a collared shirt on that says, you know, University of whatever sports performance or strength and conditioning. Right. And you look squared away. Right. No hat on. Right. Like it sets you apart. It makes an impression. And I think impressions are really important. And sometimes they get a little bit lost in the sauce because we say things, well, I had to be in the office at 5 o'clock in the morning today. And that's why I threw a hat on. Like, I get it. But how are you going to set yourself apart and set yourself on a path towards growth?
So how did you run a program for your interns, graduate assistants, and assistants? Did you have an onboarding process as a head strength coach? Did you have a system and a process? Or was this just something they learned by being around you and seeing how the other rest of the staff does it?
We had all staff meetings, right? And I was super transparent with everything that was going on. No secrets, right? When it came to budget, they knew where we were at. When it came to challenges that we were facing, they knew where we were at. When it came to ordering gear, I let them pick what they wanted. Like, hey, listen, fellas, here's what we need. We need some sweatshirts, some pants that are, you know, relatively fitted, not super baggy. We need shorts that we can train in but can also coach in. And I need some polo shirts. You guys want to get some cutoffs and some other stuff? Knock yourself out. Budget's $4,000. Go ham. Like, you got to give your staff some wins, and you can't micromanage. You know, one of the best compliments I think a boss can ever get is, you know, hey, you never made me program the way you wanted it to, right? Because you got to give your staff some guidelines, right? Say, hey, like, these are my expectations. You know, I want to start off with some prehab work as part of the warm-up. My concern population across the board, no matter what sport, is going to be, you know, shoulder stability, thoracic mobility. I need to get some glute and some hamstring warm-up going on. But however you want to skin that cat, knock yourself out, right? Like, if you want to do, you know, stuff outside the weight room where we're moving, if you want to do stuff in the weight room, like, I don't care how you do that, right? And then on the flips, and then in addition to that, we also have to have some measurable feedback, right? And I know in our profession, there's a lot of concepts around testing and, like, should it be done? Is it a 1 RM? Is it the Nebraska formula to go 3 to 5, right? Like, I don't care what your testing is, but it has to be consistent because it gives you feedback. Right. And the feedback may be the athlete's not doing the work. Right. They're not. Okay. It may be that your programming sucks. Okay. But if you don't test, if you don't have an ability to evaluate what you're doing, you have nothing to stand on. Right. And so you'll get sports performance gurus that are talking about, oh, my guys can do this, or oh, my guys can do that. Like, I'm sorry, but that guy was a stupid freak when he walked in the door. So the fact that he's got like a 37 and a half inch standing vertical doesn't have shit to do with your training. Like, but what was his vertical when he walked in the door, and what's his vertical after working for you for 3 months? Like, that's what I want to know. Right. And because coaches are tasked with athlete development, right. And, you know, depending upon what blog you read, like, oh, well, this program is sending people to the NFL. This program isn't sending people to the NFL. You know, do athletes develop? Do they progress? When I was at St. John's, I started just taking pictures of guys from the front and then from the side. So they could just honestly get really jacked up on the fact that, like, yo, my arms are coming in. Like, I can see myself changing, right? But all of a sudden, it starts to be this metric, and you can see an athlete go from, hey, he showed up as a small forward his freshman year at 186 pounds, and his senior year he left at 216 pounds, kind of looking like a pro. Shout out to DJ Kennedy. So I really think when you're designing that program, Matt, to get back to your question, it's having a process, it's having a system, right? But it's also making sure that you get feedback. You need feedback from your staff. You know, Pat, like, I don't think that testing works out. Can I get some flexibility on that? Listen, I don't care what you do, but the way we test our lower body strength is we do a front squat and it's 3 to 5 reps. Okay. If you want to RFE the crap out of somebody, like, go for it. But at the end of that 4 weeks, our measurable is that front squat, right? And it's because that gives us something to better understand how we're training.
So one of the things you touched on.
Sorry, I get fired up.
No, you're good. You're good. It's awesome. I love it. We like to let people talk on this one, so you're good. One of the things you touched on that I thought hit really, really to home with me was you don't have to program a certain way. And I've handed people my intern handbook. I created like a whole system, like, right, the intaking, and then we meet weekly, and these are the, you know, topics we meet on each week, and I kind of had like a course outline, almost like a college professor style to it. That's kind of just how I taught well. Sure. So as I would go through each week, or every couple of weeks, we would talk about different styles of programs, right? We do tier or west side or high low or whatever, and it would just rotate, and I kept adding to the book, and each semester or each year that book just kept getting bigger and bigger as I went through. And it sounds like you're taking that same approach where if a kid likes a certain type or topic, they're going to go take that information and then come teach the rest of the staff. And that was another big thing. I would have the intern, hey, you like West Side? Cool. Tell me all about it. Write this all down. Write me up a whole chapter about it. Why is it the best? Why do you like it? Why do you like the rear foot elevated squat instead of the front squat? Teach me something if you can. And I would love to hear it. If nothing else, you're going to get better at that topic that you want to teach. Yeah. I love that you are developing young coaches to actually come in and learn things as you go. I think that's such a missed piece in this. And people become so dependent upon, hey, Coach Pat Dixon, he only does freaking high, low, or upper, lower push or whatever. It doesn't matter what the crap you do. He only does this and that's all he teaches. And then we just make little crappy robots. And each generation is just a crappier copy of the last fucking paper. And then it just ends up being worse and worse as you go on. So I'm glad to hear other people are taking on that approach.
Well, Matt, think about our profession too. In the last 15 years, things that people were doing in the late 90s, early 2000s that were gospel have been shown to maybe not be the best way to do things. And honestly, I don't have enough time to read it all. So I would challenge my staff like, hey, man, you got something good, bring it, but be able to back it up and defend it. Yeah. Right. And I'm cool with that. Like I can change, I can learn. And the other thing too, like you said, like we can't be static with our training modality because our athletes are changing. They're different. They're not the same as they were 5 years ago. And they're not the same as they were 10 years ago. And the need sets have changed. And if you look at the different sports, I mean, you know, I worked in the basketball space for a number of years, and there were times where an athlete would come in, highly rated athlete, and I'm like, that guy's like 6 to 9 months away from an ACL tear because he can't hop, skip, jump, and then hold that static hold at the end of it without being all over the place. And I think part of it, right, is when you work with your coaching staffs, getting them to understand that there are going to be times where we don't agree on stuff, but that's not because I'm being insubordinate. It's because I'm trying to help our staff get better.
You should be raising the bar and pushing somebody in front of you, not just, and that's why I love that you sent them out to come back with more information and you were willing to take small pieces. I had a kid come back with something at the time. I can't remember what it was, but it was a modality I didn't know much about. And he came in with 3 research articles that broke down why I should use it for that specific population. I think it was baseball players. He came back with like Eric Cressy stuff, for example, just random couple of modalities, right? Let's bring UConn even further into this. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So it was just cool to have him come back with that.
Yeah. No, and I think too, right, as coaches, sometimes we can kind of get into our groove where we feel good, and we got to make sure that we kind of lift that head up and take a look around and kind of see what else is going on out there. You know, because just because you don't have a master's degree and 20 years in the field doesn't mean you're not smart and doesn't mean you can't add value. Right. And, you know, Steve Jobs said it best. He's like, I don't hire smart people to tell them what to do. I hire smart people to tell me what to do. And at the end of the day, right, when you're a department head, the buck stops with you. So there were times where I told my staff, listen, I can appreciate where you're coming from. I kind of like the idea, but I don't think it's fully baked yet. We're not doing it right now, but I don't want it to go away. And you got to make sure that you build that trust with your staff too, because clear communication that's consistent, that gives them feedback. Hey, this is how we're successful. This is how we're not successful. And this is how we grow. And this is how we get better. Once you define where some of those goalposts are, it allows them to achieve because they know where to aim. But if you're a coach that's constantly moving those goalposts and not giving them that direction and personal development, like every strength coach's staff should never be to have the same staff. Every head strength coach's job or every assistant AD's job is to create staff below them that have the opportunity to grow and take on more responsibility. And whether that's underneath you at the university or in another position, our goal is to support them in that. And if you have an assistant that's been, you know, working for you for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and you haven't been able to fiscally reward them as well as status reward them, I think there might be something that should be examined there.
100% agree. So again, me and Matt, having done a bunch of these, people we have on, we've picked for a reason, you included. The answers we get, and part of the reason why Matt mentioned we let people just go, right, is you're putting so many things into an answer. And as I'm taking notes, there's so many different avenues we could jump. So just kudos to you again for having not complex, but in-depth answers with a lot of concepts and a lot of ideas behind them, and not just giving us the, well, yeah, you know, we do it this way because, mm-hmm. you know? So again, part of the reason why I invited you, because we knew you'd be this way. So some of the stuff I've written down, when we talked about testing a few minutes ago, test, consistent, feedback, understanding data, and then applying it to the context, right? So
sure.
One of the things, I'm going to go jump ahead in your professional career, you added business knowledge, you added an MBA, you know, to academic-based business knowledge. So that's mm-hmm. semantics, that's the language, that's understanding the nuts and bolts, you know, financial reports, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know now with that toolkit, mm-hmm. what would you go back and tell Coach Pat Dixon, who's in his first head strength coach, assistant AD role, mm-hmm. With that new set of knowledge that could help him, even though that's not his world? His world is strength and conditioning, X's and O's of performance. And again, I'm making this grandiose because you hit mm-hmm. on so many things. To help with culture, alignment, buy-in, all the things you just referenced in terms of getting the athletes and the coaches on your side?
I think it's hard because one of the things in athletics that has a lot of cultural capital is years of experience, right? And so, you know, so when I took over at St. John's, I was 27 years old, and I'm sitting there pinching myself because I'm at MSG warming guys up and getting ready to go play some games, right? And I'm just like, didn't expect to be here this quick, but I had the opportunity. And, you know, Norm Roberts, tremendous mentor, great guy, you know, all the staff that was there. I mean, I talked to Fred Cordelbaum literally this morning via text. And so I think getting the opportunity, but then proving it every day that you belong there and can add value is really important. I think, you know, the challenge that I have with a lot of the fiscal stuff that I know now, right? So like, I get this MBA in finance because I want to know what spreadsheets are. I want to know, you know, how to do predictive analytics. I want to be able to watch budgets, you know, top line, bottom line. Like, how does this stuff really affect the operations of an organization? But I didn't have that type of access when I was 27. Right. I was told, here's my budget. But if you want something for men's basketball, maybe we can talk about it. Right. And so I think the challenge, right, is really with the athletic system in general. And how do we build a better business model? And I'm not saying that to blow anybody up. I'm just saying, like, you know, as we think of athletics as a business model, I think we're going to have to take a step back in the next couple of years, probably the next couple of months, and really reevaluate, you know, how we run things, how we spend money, where we think there is value versus where we can prove there's value. Mm-hmm. Because how we spend those dollars is really important. And so, you know, you think of things like, you know, per diem, right? And meals, right? Everybody who's ever been on a track team anywhere in America, other than like the top five programs, knows that like track programs scrap it together. Like it is like, hey, here's your $10 travel money, go figure it out. Like, and you know, it's really hard with $10 to, you know, to make a meal out of that on the road that's like super healthy, right? So Olive Garden, shout out, like it ends up being a spot. But I think taking a, you know, going back, like you were talking about, what I would tell myself is start to look at the bigger picture and how some of these chess pieces start to play together and why money gets spent, where it gets spent, and how it gets spent. Out of everything that I did at St. John's over 7.5 years, my proudest accomplishment was bringing Muscle Milk in there and being able to transition that from a spending line item for men's and women's basketball to a department-wide deal that got a fridge put in the other weight room that serviced teams like baseball, lacrosse, everybody else at the university. Because to me, being an ex-track guy, it was really important on how I could use the skills and the resources at my disposal to be able to help people other than the teams that I work with. Because as a coach, I think, and this is why I got into private business, and this is why I work at AMP Human, it's how do I just help people be the best versions of themselves? How do I help somebody get a win that day? And there were some teams where, you know, kids would show up at St. John's and they'd get their workout in the morning in the other weight room, and like they'd go straight to class. They didn't have time to get a snack, right? So the opportunity to grab a Muscle Milk and a bar on the way out the door, like that was meaningful recovery nutrition. And so I know I'm getting long-winded and I'm hoping you'll be able to edit this stuff, but it's really important to me that coaches understand that they wield a very special relationship with their athletes, and they have a very unique insight into the day-to-day course that their athletes take, their stresses, you know, what's going on in their personal lives. Like, you have a really unique opportunity to have a positive impact in young men and young women's lives on a daily basis. Don't neglect that. Don't take that for granted. Understand it's powerful, and understand that you have the opportunity to help people and make people smile in a way and help them grow in a way that not a lot of other people in their life have the opportunity to do.
No, that's awesome. And it's a point, you know, again, knowing you two and us knowing each other from who we learn from, it's a point. It's kind of not only what we each personally do, but it's also the way we were taught. So it's kind of that both that nature versus nurture. We all are inherently that kind of person, but then we had people reinforcing it. So as we drove it out to the athletes we worked with, it was just how we did things. So, and again, there's a story, I've referenced it a few times for anyone listening, I won't reference it again, about you referenced it as proving it every day. Powell talked to me about it as treat every day like you're new, and constantly show up. I mean, you referenced a lot of things even earlier in the conversation. You're the temperature of the room, you know, on the 85th day of training in a row, and we're 20 games into the season. Yeah, okay, you can be that guy, or you can be this guy and bring everyone up. So you prove it every day is not only to yourself and to the people, but it's also in how you interact and do everything. You hit another key one. You referenced playing chess. Glenn Kane, shout out to Glenn Kane, currently Rutgers. He's a UConn intern, Kansas guy, the whole bit. He always would say, and it was something I loved and I've taken it with me everywhere, is if you're playing checkers, you're having fun, but you're playing the wrong game. Because in the chess versus checkers battle, the board looks the same, but they're not the same game. So again, just one of those, you reference playing chess, and to this effect, a lot of people, they're playing checkers, they don't even realize chess exists, and then they don't even realize there's things like Go. There's a whole other level to go behind where, to your point, you're not even exposed to the budget. Understanding it's one thing, being exposed to it's another, and then making decisions around it is a whole other world. Yeah. So just something to open people's perspective if they're not familiar with it. The one thing, now I'll flip the question, right? I asked it, this is the follow-up. What did you take moving into that business world? And let's get into that. So now you're a strength coach. You've done all these things to develop others, not only as athletes, but as people, the people who worked for you. Mm-hmm. So now you have this additional education. You move into the business sector, you know, outside of athletics. So let's get some color around that. How'd you make the transition? Why? When? You know, what decision, you know, how did you make a decision? Did you talk to people? Did you just do it? Was it the fifth thing you looked at that you jumped on, you know? So how did you move in? And then what tools, skills, whatever it may be, did you bring from a coach perspective into that business role to help you be successful?
Sure. So the reason for the MBA was it was either an MBA or a PhD. I was looking to just further my horizons. My whole plan was to actually move up into senior administration. That's really what I wanted to do. I still have friends that are just like, yeah, Pat, you'll end up in AD one day. It's going to happen. And to me, it was really about, hey, you know, you can see how all of these different units play together, right? And you've learned, your philosophy's developed along the way. So I'd really hope I get the opportunity someday to step back into that space. It's a really wonderful space. But I can also say that when I met Jeff Byers, who's AMP Human CEO, and I met Erica, who's our COO, they're our co-founders, I was really intrigued by the idea of our product, which is called PR Lotion. And it basically makes sodium bicarbonate accessible via a lotion. And so the thing that really sold me was A, it worked, but B, they were committed to the science. And in all of the messaging that we had talked about, it was really about making sure that the science was there. So here I am, like, working on my MBA. I get introduced to Jeff. And it's kind of like this interesting thing going on, because I'm watching him as he's thinking about spinning this company off of a larger biotech. And that's kind of where we came from. And I had been consulting with a couple of other companies. I'd been working with a genetics company in Southern California. I'd been working with a company called Masimo, which makes heart rate technology. So I had had a bunch of different stuff going on. I was really intrigued by just how high performance and business kind of interacted, and how there were people on the business side that were making decisions that had no clue how coaches would use a technology. And then on the flip side of it, there were coaches that are just like, well, I'm never going to spend that type of money on that technology, that had no idea how much R&D and money went into developing something that they perceived as simple. And for me, that's really the niche that I saw myself in. You know, and in talking with Jeff and Erica and eventually joining the team, it was really interesting to me, because my core tenets are, I want to help people. I want to help people get their win, whether that's winning a Super Bowl, whether that's more combat effective on mission, or whether that's, you know, feeling better in the morning after their workout while they're trying to get back to their kids. Those are all equal wins. And so joining this company, it's really an opportunity to kind of step forward and bring something to the masses in a larger way. And so AMP Human's ethos is we're a human performance company that wants to help people perform, evolve, and adapt, right? And so, or perform, adapt, and evolve. Pardon me, let me get it right. And so performance is those moments of sweat, right? The adaption is what happens in the near term, but then that evolution is what happens over time, right? And so you're not going to lose a ton of weight in 3 week period of time. But if you're consistent with your training, the overall evolution is like, hey, you cut 10, 15 pounds, and all of a sudden your running mechanics start to change, right? Or in the weight room, right? Like, you're not going to increase massive gains, you know, in a primary lift in a short period of time. But as you adapt to that strain, all of a sudden you can evolve into a stronger person. And so for me, it was really having the business acumen. It was about sharpening some skills. You know, I had been used to reading, you know, budget sheets and stuff like that at that point. But it was really about having that acumen and really being able to step into a room, be able to sit down at a table with, you know, PhD doctors, orthopedic surgeons, and, you know, the guy carrying the line item for the team, and being able to have a conversation with all three of them and not be at a disadvantage, right? Because it's about how you bring all of those skills together so that they overlap, so that when you go into a team and you have a conversation about, hey, it's going to cost $5,000 to run this program for the next 3 months, right? You know that the $5,000 is going to be hard to come by, but you've got buy-in from the strength coach because he understands the performance benefit. You've got buy-in because you've had the conversation with the athletic trainer. And so both of them then can have that conversation with the person who carries the budget and is eventually going to cut that check. And so that they understand the value that you're bringing, because a lot of people, when they see a dollar sign, they're immediate, well, no, like, it's just the cost money. And it's like, well, if it does this, 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 and this, like, it's actually going to save you time and money over time. And it brings me back to that original comment, which was, if you lose your staff every 12 to 18 months, how much money are you wasting on trying to hire staff versus, hey, if I spend a little bit more money up front, I keep them, I don't have to worry about it, and I've got some continuity. And I think, you know, that's really the big challenge, right? We've got people who are bean counters, not knocking it. There are people who are practitioners in the field saying, I need something. But how do we make sure that those two spaces can overlap and both sides can realize there's value here? And that's really the gap that I'm trying to fill.
one of the big things, and before I know Matt's got something he's going to jump in on, we referenced it in a previous conversation we had, and Paul, jump in with me. I forget how Andy said it. I always say it is you connect the dots of different disciplines. So it's the D3, it's the dots of different disciplines, because what most people have is a single skill set in their single way, and that's what they leverage, and they lose sight of the global, you know, they're in their, you know, they get tunnel vision, they're in their niche. But what I think, and again, from my experience, not only strength coaches, I think strength coaches gravitate this way more because you have to implement a multidisciplinary approach in continuity versus in silo. Because again, look in the early 2000s, you did your recovery work, you did your thing, it was in silo. You did a methodology slash modality as a thing versus, yeah, well, why did you do this here versus there and this much versus that much? So I think, and again, personal opinion, the really good strength coaches, not defined by how much money they make or who they worked with, the really good ones who had mastery of the knowledge of human performance could do the D3. They could connect different disciplines. And I think fundamentally that's just a big thing if you're a person who can do that.
Yeah. I think the hard part, Matt, do you want to jump in there?
No, you're good. I was just going to say the only D3 that I completely respect is Mighty Ducks 3 in the college years. That's the only D3 I like. So I don't know what all this discipline talk is about. That was a great movie. Sorry, continue.
Hey, is that the newest one that they're going to rehash and redo and remake?
I hope not. I think they're just going to make it even worse. I mean, I'm tired of reboots personally, but just random. Sorry, continue.
Dude, if they go after the Sandlot, I'm going to blow up a building, all right? That's all I got to say about that.
I got the dog for it. I got a Mastiff. We can take Mango. We'll put Mango in.
Right. I think, right, so the challenge as a strength coach and as an athletic trainer, as a physical therapist, as a sport coach, is sometimes we're all pulling so hard in our direction to find quote-unquote success that we don't understand we need to take a step back and define what success is, right? And our job as strength coaches is to work with the athlete to help them be as physically fit and as physically prepared for competition as possible, right? And that needs to be the blanket for the physical therapist and the athletic trainer. Like, we can't be pulling on different sets of needs, right? And so I think programs are doing a much better job of integrating those different spaces and understanding that this isn't a turf war. And if somebody's got to be pulled out of the weight room to do some athletic training related stuff, like, that's not a bad thing, right? But on the other side, like, we need to make sure that we're having that communication so that we have a consistent, not return to play protocol, return to perform protocol. Because the problem is if all I'm doing is training that athlete to get back, like, think of an ACL tear, like, oh, well, their strength in both legs matches in a leg extension, let's say. Okay, well, how detrained is the leg that you're comparing it against? Because that person hasn't been able to do much because you've constantly been pulling them into the training room to do quote unquote exercises. So the challenge, right, becomes how do you communicate with your athletic trainer? And strength coaches are just as guilty. Like, this isn't a one-sided paradigm here. This is, strength coaches need to understand, like, there's certain shit you don't know. And it's okay. It's okay for you not to know, right? But your job is to surround yourself with people and talk with people and collaborate with people that do know, right? So when an injury happens, like, okay, like, you know, what are the checkpoints? And I think that's the second thing, right? Like, I am not a fan of throwing time at things unless it is planned time. So if you're telling me that athlete A can't do something at the end of the week when we expected them to, what's the next step? Because if you're telling me that we just need to give them more time, I can take that a little bit, but, like, did we diagnose properly? Has the athlete been doing their thing, like, properly? Have they been getting enough rest? Or have they been out at the bar dancing on a tabletop? Because there is an athlete in my past that re-tore her ACL because she was at a bar dancing on the bar top, right? And everybody's like, oh, the surgery must not have taken. I'm like, bullshit, right? So
I can't tell you how many strange coaches, because I have a dozen of those, not necessarily Denson and Bar Tops, but I got a dozen of like the athletic trainers or the doctors being like, well, you know, and in the back of my head, I'm like, well, you know, the story of how they were hammered and fell down a flight of stairs this weekend might have contributed, but you don't know that.
Yeah. So I think it really is getting everybody on the same page and just saying like, hey, okay, what does success look like in this situation? And then working steps backwards so that we have checkpoints, we have accountability. And so that if we get to a point where we're not making the progress that we need, we can take a look back at it and say, okay, we need to reevaluate this because either the athlete's not healing properly, B, we misdiagnosed what's going on, or C, the program's just not working to strengthen what we're trying to strengthen. In which case you have the opportunity to course correct versus if you just throw time at stuff, well, you know, we'll have to wait until next week and we'll retest them. Like, what does that mean? Like at the pro level, time is money. Like a hamstring injury that takes 3 weeks to heal versus 6 weeks to heal. That's three games. Okay. Which is 3 out of 16 paychecks that athlete's not on the gridiron for.
100%. I love the fact that you went into reverse engineering and you talked about how you break everything down. As the only dumbass in this talk without an MBA, how do you make that transition from, you know, like I said, you did an amazing job breaking down, all right, hey, I took this skill from coaching and this skill from coaching. Mm-hmm. But I guess for the guy who's sitting here without it, and, you know, I know a lot of strength coaches like myself who want to do more of that stuff, want to learn more about the entrepreneur side. Tell me more about how you've used it in other, you know, either side hustles, obviously you're still working with AMP, but other mm-hmm. things in your career or outside of your specialty where you've been able to use that, please.
So it's really about building that network, right? And then those opportunities pop up, right? So I actually just designed, I call it like a weight training blueprint for a company that's going to be launching a number of products behind it along with an app. And they're doing some really cool things there. But I got that introduction from somebody who I had met from the business side of things. They're like, well, Pat, like you've got this total background. Like, you know, what do you think? And so you have that conversation. But again, if I hadn't always presented myself as a professional, again, not always in a collared shirt, but looking sharp, looking professional, right? Then you don't get that opportunity. And I think there are a lot of really, really smart people out there that might be missing some of these opportunities to grow and do other things, like you talked about side hustles, because maybe they're just missing a presentation capability or, you know, how they speak, you know, needs to be kind of cleaned up a little bit. I curse a little bit too much. I'm working on it. The swear jar in my household has
right there with you, man. Right there with you. It fucking kills me every time.
but again, it comes back to presentation, right? And so, you know, in the military space, right? Like, there is some very clearly defined ways to communicate with each other, right? And so whenever I get, you know, emails from military personnel, it always says VR at the end, right? They're very aware of, you know, him, her, like all this stuff, right? And so what's really important and a learning opportunity there is how you communicate being effective, the idea of a bluff, right? I mean, here it is, bottom line up front. Bang, bang, bang. This is what you need to know. Colors behind it. In the science space, I'm so used to putting my rationale up front with a summary at the end. Like, that's inverted now. But I think, you know, looking at it as a strength coach, I think we need to be constant learners. I think we need to figure out where we want to be. There might be some guys in the space that are like, hey, I can design equipment better. And so I need to take a welding class at the local Votech so I can learn to weld properly because I got this really great idea for an attachment for a rack. Like, take some time and chase some of these things, but also make sure that, you know, you're putting some structure around it and saying, okay, this is the amount of money I'm going to sink into this. Once it clears $500, it either better be at 80% ready to go or it's scrap metal, right? And that's the other thing, right? Like, how many guys do you know that have said, oh, I want to write books. I want to write a book, or I wish I wrote more articles, right? But they don't take the, yeah, but they don't take the time to really kind of say, okay, well, if I was to write an article, what are the things that really interest me? What am I passionate about? Mm-hmm. And then the other piece is just talking with other people. It's one thing to like go to a webinar and just be like this, but how much are you engaging with the speakers? You know, we've all done a ton of the CSCCA and the NSCA conferences and coaches conferences. But when you go up and you shake a guy's hand, you say, hey, I really appreciate that conference or that presentation you just put together. I'd love to follow up with you on this. How many people actually get that guy's card and chase him down? They don't.
How many people even go up to him? And that was, I've always said, I mean, I've had this conversation with both of you. Like, when I go to something, I don't want to talk to the people who I went with. Like, if I'm spending time, and again, maybe this is a commentary on the industry because it's very clicky and it's very built in a certain channel and you're in your channel compared to others.
Sure.
I would go to conferences. I mean, and again, I know I'm known this way. Like, I did it purposefully. I'm known at those conferences for coming and talking to everyone. I know people, they would see me coming and be like, I do not want to talk to that guy. Who the hell is that guy? But I purposely didn't talk to the people who I knew, because the only way for me to grow, to know someone else, to connect dots, or when I was in the sales side trying to sell product, was to talk to people I didn't know. Because if I only talked to the people I know, I was limited to the people I knew. So it's kind of that, again, trying to distill down some of these things, there's the idea of taking the knowledge you have around you. And again, I'm taking some of what you said and transitioning it to a question. Taking the knowledge you have around you from the people you've learned from, harnessing it and getting the most out of it. How can you be most effective with what's in your bubble? But then when do you, and again, this is the question part, when do you step outside of that? When do you recognize that if all you know is your bubble, you're limited to your bubble? So how do you define those moments, those people, those conversations where you're keeping to your core beliefs because that's your bubble, but then you're also saying, you know what, let me come over here, maybe shift, change, whatever it is, because if I'm only in my bubble, I'm only in my bubble.
Yeah. So I think the first thing, right, is as a coach, I used to say, get comfortable being uncomfortable. Other people talk about growth mindset. Other people say, hey, you're in your comfort zone. You need to step outside your comfort zone. You can't give that advice to other people if you're not willing to take it. Right. And I have yet to be at a conference where somebody walked up to somebody else and introduced themselves. And the person that they introduced themselves with was like, fuck you, get away from me. I don't want to talk to you. Have yet to see that. Right. And again, I've only been doing this for like 17 or shit, it's 2020. So yeah, I've only been going to conferences for like 18 or 19 years at this point, but I have yet to see somebody snap back, right? And so I think if I was talking to a young strength coach right now, I would say, if you're going to walk up and shake a guy's hand, look him in the eye, and have a good question to ask, right? Don't be a groupie, right? Because the worst thing you could do, I remember Mike Wojcik spoke on this. He was the strength coach for the Patriots, and then he worked for Dallas, right? He had this thing where he wouldn't take interns on, because he didn't want just another guy hanging around throwing the ball with Tom Brady, or it was Drew Bledsoe back in the day, right? Like, he wasn't looking for that. And I think if you're a young strength coach and you walk up to somebody, you know, hey, Coach so-and-so, I was really impressed with your presentation. You know, one question I had about it was blah, 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 blah. I know you're trying to meet a bunch of people now. Could I get a card or a phone number or an email so I can follow up and we can maybe talk about this at another time? Like, how hard is that?
Yeah. Right? Guys on the internet now have so many good opportunities for you to do that as well. Like, if you read somebody like Tim Ferriss or somebody similar to that, those gurus about being able to session network, Malcolm Gladwell, or guys similar to Simon Sinek, those guys all have these amazing interview questions they recommend you ask. And those are stuff, things you can use, excuse me, in ways that will basically help you get more jobs and more opportunities and more connections. And people just don't take advantage of them, either because they're unaware or because they think somehow that their buddy's going to be able to hook them up every single time for a job, which is just stupid.
Yeah. Well,
Matt, sorry to cut you off, Pat. Let me jump in. You mentioned Tim Ferriss. There's an amazing one, and people have asked me this. How did I get connected to people? And it was actually something that I stole from Tim Ferriss when he talks about how he was teaching at Princeton. I think it was one of his professors, and then he did it when he was teaching, is he would challenge the kids, like, you know, whoever can get an interview with President Clinton, I'll pay for a vacation anywhere in the world for you. and half the people never even tried. Then half the people that did, you know, half of those people sent one email. Mm-hmm. But it was the person who took like three or four steps actually got it. Like, and he has some crazy examples. I think Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, I think Bill Clinton was one of them. But I took that, you know, again, reading his stuff and hearing that, and also having mentors who told me very similar things. There were people who I've met in this industry and people we're going to have on this podcast or have already had, and people who I've connected, you know, the both of you guys to for business or for development. Literally, I just said hi. And to your point, Pat, I have never gotten a like, go fuck yourself, I don't want to talk to you. I've gotten a lot of, hey, I'm busy, I don't have time. I've gotten a lot of, hey, look, I'm not really interested, you know, I don't want to buy anything from you. And you got to go back and be like, no, like, I'm actually not trying to like soft sell you and be like, hi, and then send you a message of like, here's my thing. It's like, I actually just want to say like, hi. And having that as you got to try, you actually got to put yourself out there. You got to connect with people, I think, is your big point, Pat. Like, if you don't even go up to the person, you have no idea what they're going to do. Like, but your first step is actually like going up and being like, hey, I'm Joe.
Yeah, no, and I have to say, as a field, I think there are some really wonderful people that are strength coaches. I think they're really wonderful. They are open. They are willing to share. You know, I can't tell you how many big time football coaches I've talked to, and I've been like, hey, you know, how do you come up to your program? And they're like, what's your email? I'll just send it to you. Like, they're like, there's nothing special about my program. I mean, there's no secret trickery. Mm-hmm. It's how you coach it.
So
right? Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. When going along with that, though, what is and this is something we already kind of touched on, but what is some of the worst advice you hear get thrown around, specifically from guys like yourself who are kind of in that middle ground, right? Where you're selling, but you also have that amazing strength and conditioning background. What are some of the worst advice you've heard?
I'm not interested. Right. The reason I say that isn't because it's self-serving. It's because they're not willing to take 3 minutes to maybe learn something that's outside their box, right? Because we know that, like, when the Polar team system dropped, the original team system was like 2001. Chris West, actually, back at UConn, got like one of the first sets, right? And everybody's like, I don't know. I don't see the benefit of it, right? And then we slowly start to come to understand, like, some of that heart rate technology stuff is really good, right? And so I think when you can't make 5 minutes to potentially learn about something new, it shows a closed mindset and it means you're not learning, which means your athletes are actually going to pay for it in the long run. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't evolve as a coach, your skill set, your philosophy, what you do with your, so I think the worst thing I've ever heard is like, I don't have time for that.
Right. Well, and again, it's when you make it about you, one of the things, I mean, we talk about it all the time, and I actually, here's a funny one. At a national conference with a guy in a polo repping his place. I won't reference his name. He's still in the profession. I don't think highly of him. I think he's a dickhead. I asked him, I was like, what are you going to punch me? Like, are you going to fight me? Like in your fucking polo with your school logo? Like, are we going to get in fist fight in the middle of the thing? Yeah. And it was because we were in a conversation. We had some mutual friends. We're all standing there talking. And I referenced how I was at UConn, so I was a GA, and I said, you know, I think the biggest problem in the profession is people make it about them. It's their program. It's their philosophy. It's their thing. I was like, yep. It's servant leadership. Like, if I only do what I believe, I'm not helping my athletes, because that might not be what the best thing for my athlete is. And if I'm not constantly learning, growing, expanding, I don't have all the tools to help that person, and I'm limiting who I can help. And this particular person, you know, came at me with, well, you know, you're the coach, you got to dictate. And I kind of shot back at him some snarky shit. And that person having a big ego because the logo on their shirt, I said to him, I was like, well, you know, what are you going to fucking fight me for? And, you know, it was the pissing contest of, it's about you versus about who you're helping. And I think that's one of the biggest things we lose. strength conditioning versus athletic training.
Sure.
It's about you. It's not about the athlete. And that's, I think a lot can be said there, but we don't have to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you were to boil it down to what is the sign of a great strength coach, it's that he can leave the room and the workout still happens the way it's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't want my athletes to fear me. I want them to respect me. And the only way they'll respect you is that if they understand the knowledge that you're bringing to the table is about helping them achieve their goal, then you'll get that respect. But if you have to use a thundering voice or the threat of bear crawls around a football field, like, that's fear. And that's, it doesn't allow for that growth mindset. And so, you know, as a strength coach, like, if you can have your team in that room, everybody knows what they're doing, they're working, they're doing their thing, you're coaching up cues, you know, a couple of kids might need a little motivation here and there, but if you can leave the room to have a conversation with a recruit and the parents are looking through the window into the weight room and things are still like doing their thing and people are losing their, that's a sign of a great program. And I think that consistency then starts to boil over into other spaces. Like, you know, part of discipline, part of being in the weight room is learning about how to act right, because we not only make better athletes, but some of the lessons that can be learned about hard work, dedication, being comfortable, being uncomfortable, not being afraid to fail, following through, are things that make them better sons and daughters, better significant others, better parents down the road, better employees, right? Because, you know, we're in a day and age now where, like, when things get tough at a job, like, there are kids that just quit. They're just like, nah, I'll go find another one. Right. Versus like leaning in and understanding, like, hey, here's where your skills fall short. It's okay to fail. That's not an indictment on who you are. It's an indictment on what happened. But there's also an opportunity to learn from it in order to grow. And so, you know, to get back to the conversation you were having with that strength coach, like, a coach should be able to leave. And if they have truly instilled culture in their program, right? Culture is this ultimate buzzword. Like, if you're a great coach and you leave, the kids should still be doing like your culture a year down the road. Like, you know, how you call it up, how you talk to each other, how you dress, you know, the expectation, like, we don't leave stuff out. Like, those simple things become part of that culture. And if, in my mind, again, humble opinion, is that, you know, if you leave and you look back and your kids are just like, no, like, this is how we do things, then you've done the job.
You left it as a better place. And yeah, absolutely. And yeah. One other thing you touched on was showing your value every day, or showing your value to your athletes consistently, where they know why you're there, why you're that strength coach. It's not that you're the asshole who yells. Occasionally I was that guy. Absolutely. Especially in the football space, which obviously has a whole separate bag of crap to deal with, but
there's a time and a place.
Absolutely. And so working with NFL and working with tactical, you learn quickly that as soon as they don't understand that you, or think that you have the answer, they're going to stop asking you. So you need to show that value and bring in new things and go out and make yourself better in order to make them better. And that's when they start to respect you. And then you get that buy-in and things just get so much easier.
Yeah. But also being able to say, hey, you know what, Matt, I don't have the answer to that right now, but give me 2 days and then come up, hit me in the office in the afternoon. And we'll be able to hash through that, because vulnerability is actually something that's really empowering. And yes, a booming voice commands a room. Absolutely. But you also have to make sure that there's that value set of, you know, it's so cliche, right? They have to know you care before they care what you know. Mm-hmm. Right. And that really is important. And then by making it about helping them and what their goal set is, it really helps things evolve more organically and in a way that's going to be meaningful and lasting.
Yeah. Well, in the long term, you can fight Google and all the terrible information out there, the way that Joe fights a douchebag in a polo, you know what I mean? Just ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Pat, you hit a huge word, vulnerability, that I always associate with Patrick Lencioni. So big shout out to people who, if they're listening and they don't know who Patrick Lencioni is, suggest getting his books, suggest reading his books. Shout out to Mo Butler, first person to ever give me a Patrick Lencioni book, Death by Meeting. That one's for you, Mo. So you referenced growth mindset and respect, and buy-in. And Matt, you're talking about if people don't believe you have the answers to help them continue to grow, they're going to just say, okay, well, whatever. And in this day and age where it's at the fingertips, the guru, the next best, Pat, how have you taken all your experiences working with 18 to 22 year olds who have the guru fingertips and brought that into the business sense now, working with the adults where same thing, respect, giving the answers, being vulnerable to say, I don't know, or this is what I think, but let me get you a better answer in order to be successful in business. So how did you take that from what you did with the 18 to 22 year olds to now doing it with the adults on a business level?
So admitting what you don't know is really important, especially in the scientific community. So our scientific advisory board is world class. And the comment that basically came back from all of them was, the reason I got interested in what you were up to was because you were willing to say that you weren't the perfect hammer for everything and that there was a lot of things that you didn't know, but you were working on finding out, right? So, you know, the chair of our scientific advisory board is Brad Wilkins, who's currently a professor at Gonzaga. He led Nike's high performance lab for close to a decade. You know, and then part of that list, right, Brett Kirby, who's Ilya Kipchoge's coach. Ilya just broke the two-hour marathon. We've got Per Lundstrom, who is the director of HP for Red Bull. I've got another gentleman, Paul DeTuro, who spent a ton of time in the military special operations space.
We got some mutual friends with him.
Yes. So you know, him. We've got Nigel Mitchell, who was the nutritionist for Team Ineos, which is a cycling team. We've got Jason Siegler, who is probably one of the top three researchers in sodium bicarb on the planet. We've got Andy Jones, who's another muscle physiologist out of the University of Exeter. Like, we have, and Hobie Darling, who's actually the head of the Luminal Collective, our co-founder. But we've got these people, and the biggest thing was like, hey, we have these challenges, we have these problems that we're trying to solve, and we don't have all the answers, right? Like, PR lotion isn't the answer for everything, right? It's not the only thing. And I think allowing for that vulnerability allowed for people to ask questions, because it showed that we as a company at Amp Human were willing to be open, to kind of lay the cupboard there and say, hey, you know, pressure test this, right? Like, how do we get better? And I think a lot of people, if they were protective of their strength conditioning program, they wouldn't be willing to kind of just open it up and say, hey, what do you see is wrong with it? Or how can we make it better? They'd kind of be a little bit more closed up. And so in the business space, right, vulnerability allows for innovation. It allows for open conversation. It allows for people to present at a table and not feel like the CEO is going to big time you, right? That's why the CEO never leads with their opinion. They always say, hey, what are everybody's thoughts? Let's go around the table. And so it's really about developing that EQ to take into the business space that you develop as a coach, because, you know, for me being a white guy working with predominantly African-American basketball players, I'm like the Antichrist. Like, I am not the person that they want to be barked at from, right? So you spend a lot of time trying to get them to understand, I want for you, I don't want from you. And they're not used to that type of relationship. There are a lot of people out there that are very used to relationships being transactional. They're very used to like some type of quid pro quo type of thing. And when they get to a situation where somebody's willing to put energy into them, where they're not asking for something back necessarily, kind of throws them for a loop. And in business, it's the same thing, right? Like on a sales call, so many people are, hey, you want to buy some product? Versus, you know, hey, what's the biggest challenge that your department's facing during COVID right now?
Yeah.
Right? Like, teach me. I want to learn from you. Right? Maybe I have something that can help with that. Maybe I don't. Right? But asking the question, right? Because the tactical operator, Matt, that you're dealing with has such a varied scope of work, right? It's wild. So if you walked into a situation where you were at Benning versus you were at Little Creek versus you were at Coronado versus you were at Tampa, yeah, you might be in the tactical operations community, but you're dealing with totally different shit. Totally. Right. Sand, 10th mountain, right? Like, okay. Yeah. I hang out in the freezing space all the time. Right. Hi, I'm in the hot space all the time. Hey, I'm typically underwater with a rebreather and nitrox mixed in. You know, I spend 6 or 7 hours a day underwater. Like, so you have to get to understand the community that you're talking to, and ask questions that can help you better understand what their challenges are. And I think in business, that's really the biggest thing that I've learned and that's carried over from coaching. It's asking questions about the challenges that your client faces and saying, you know what, I don't have anything that can help you with that, but you know what, I got two buddies over at this other company. You should really call them. They might be able to give you some insight into a potential solution. There are some calls that I get off of where I have nothing to add for value other than connecting them to somebody that might be able to help them out. And to me, that's still a win because, you know, when you're in the high performance space, when you're in business, it's really about connecting people to help everybody kind of rise that tide. Steve Lavin at St. John's, rising tide raises all ships, mm-hmm. right? And so positive influence, positive energy, trying to help people out, good things come back to you. And I'm a big believer in karma.
Oh, awesome, man. And again, there's so many ways we could go with what you just said, because there's so many avenues we could dive into and hammer out. So we're actually going to shift gears for you. Okay. We have, for everybody we talk to, we always ask them the same three questions to kind of, no matter how the conversation goes or what that person's background is, we always can kind of fall back on to, you know, the big three, the terrific three, whatever you want to call it. You know, most people who are doing what we're attempting to do. So the first one, and it's actually going to open up the door for you to get into a little bit more of your personal life and managing your time commitments and stuff, is how do you find balance? And balance, not necessarily in terms of the perfect equilibrium, but how do you approach managing your personal and professional pulls, you know, all the different elements within that, family, significant other, side hustle, you know, how do you go about it? What tools, what skills do you, can you recommend? And then, you know, ultimately what's your method and how you got there?
So balance to me is an impossibility. It's about boundaries. Because I think if you're passionate about anything, whether it's learning to play guitar and being a musician, whether it's being a chef, an artist, a strength coach, an accountant, a computer programmer, if you're truly passionate about that, you're never going to have a balance because you're always going to be really excited about what you're doing, right? But it is about creating boundaries. And those boundaries are important because they kind of keep you on track. So I have a thing with my fiance. 6:30 is a hard stop. Like, I better be home at 6:30. And that's not because she's manipulative or trying to control me. It's just that I respect her enough to understand, like, I can't spend all day working on my project and then not make sure that I'm nurturing other things. Because just like any gardener will tell you, when you ignore a section of your garden, it will die. Right. And so you've got to make sure that you're watering all those different things in your life and you're caring for them. So I think it's really about boundaries. And then it's also about, you know, kind of presenting that list of priorities. You know, I spoke the other day at a USC thing for MBAs, and, you know, we were talking about how, like, you know, what's the startup space like, right? And people are like, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to be an entrepreneur. And it's like, are you prepared to live on ramen for 2 years and work 80 hours a week? Okay, you're not ready to be an entrepreneur. You're just not, right? And I think it's really commitment to craft, right? So, you know, if you are really into something and you're trying to start a business, you've got kind of these checkpoints that you go through that if you're making progress and the growth is there, then you keep committing that time to it. But you also have to get to a point where, like, this is the end of the road. Like, I gave it the time that I could give to it. Now I've got to reset my focus. You know, so with Amp Human, I looked at it and said, you know, okay, I'm going to give this thing 18 months and see what happens, right? It may blow up and it may be amazing, and it is, and it's going to keep doing that. we got an AFWERX military contract for some research, $1.5 million. Like, freaking awesome. All right. But there's also the opportunity where it could have gone to zero, you know, and that doesn't mean the product is bad. It could mean the timing was off. It could mean COVID had hit a year earlier. Anything could happen. And so there are a lot of businesses that kind of die on the vine, not because they were bad businesses, but because they just, the circumstances just didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so I think having realistic expectations about the risks that you're going to take. I'm a squirrel. I save money. I am always socking away a chunk of my paycheck and living frugally. I think anybody out there that's not saving at least 15 to 20% of their salary every week, every pay period, is foolish, because you've got no buffer, right? Like, and I feel bad for a lot of people right now because they don't have that buffer. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really the thing. So getting back to those boundaries, right? Like, there's Hobie Darling says, it calls it the 70-20-10 rule. So 70% of things are like, we know they're going to be there, right? Matt, do you know this rule?
Yeah, I love this rule. I'm glad. Keep going. I love it.
Right. So 70% of the things are the things that we know. They're things that we can hit. They're objectives that can be seen, related to, and accomplished, right? 20% is like those that risk area, right? It's we think it's going to work, but it's not a 100% sure thing. So we're going to go there because we see some upside, right? And then that last group, that 10%, that's the moonshot. That's, Red Bull Stratus. Like, hey, I'm going to go jump. Like, it's some craziness, right? But it was really neat because what they did was they brought this whole team around that project. And then all of a sudden, the guys who's designing the suit, like, hey, they want to throw some time in, and the people designing the gauges, and then the people that are designing this and that and this and that. And all of a sudden, like, industry gets together and really starts to collaborate on something that's special. And nobody expected to make money on it. But then on the flip side of it, oh my gosh, like, we've got some technology that came out of this that's really going to help an industry, and we're actually going to be able to monetize somehow. So I think it's really important in your own personal life to understand that there's the meat and potatoes that you better be paying attention to, right? There's the things that, like, okay, I can do a little bit of risk. I can afford to dabble in those. And then there's like that 10% moonshot. But if you're taking 50% of your time and putting it into that 10% category, you're setting yourself up for failure.
100%. You knocked it out of the park as usual. You've been crushing this whole deal. So I absolutely love it, man. So that follows me up to my next question, which is, as a saver, which is something that I'm notorious for as well amongst my friends, I'm a big time, I'm cheap. So what is the best investment you've ever made of $500 or less for yourself or for your business?
So I'm going to give you two.
Send it.
$500, when I took the job at St. John's, I bought myself a new suit. And it was because we had games at Madison Square Garden and coaches were wearing suits. And it was the first time that I had spent, some really good money on a suit. But it was totally worth it because I felt like I belonged there. Right. And I'm working with some coaches that are making, how basketball is, like, making a ton more money. Right. And I felt like I belonged there. And it really helped my own kind of personal ego to kind of just be in that space. And then the second one was Christmas gifts for my staff. And it wasn't a lot of money, right? But every year, get them a little something. Might be dinner with their significant others. I had a cleaning lady in my building at LMU that every year I would leave her a Christmas card and a bottle of champagne, just saying thank you for everything that she did. I think you have to be mindful of your staff. And I think you have to be mindful of the people that allow you to do your job. Because if the cleaning lady in my building didn't take care of things the way that she took care of them, then that's another thing I have to worry about.
Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you up.
Yeah, no,
two huge takeaways there, man. One, take care of your staff. I remember you know, back before I came to the tactical space where everything obviously is very different and very colleague level versus kind of the hierarchy, I would thank them every day, whether it's GA, intern, doesn't matter who they were. It was a thank you, a handshake. And then every single, you know, at least once a week, I take them to breakfast just to say, thank you for everything you do. And then your second part to that, that suit idea is so smart because that imposter mentality, at least I know I had it when I first got my first, you know, assistant job, GA job, head strength coach job, even tactical job. I just felt like I wasn't supposed to be there. I felt like I was just out of place. So you said it perfectly. You said, I felt like I belonged. I was in Madison Square Garden. I was in the same place, you know, Jordan, Bird, Starks, Ewing, all those guys came and played and tore it up. And you were there and you were felt like you belonged there. And that is just such an important piece. So sorry to cut you off, but I want to
you're good because I think the two categories that really sit nicely there are you've got to invest in yourself and you've got to make sure that you remember everybody else around you. Right. And so you could be making, you know, $10 million a year, right? A great story to share. Abigail up at Michigan. I hope you're okay with this. But Jim Harbaugh bringing water bottles out to practice this year. Right. She told me a story about how she was stocking shelves down with water or whatever. And the offensive coordinator came down and she thought he was just going to grab one. And he literally started stocking the shelf and then got other staff to come down and help out too. Right. Like you got to remember that this is a team effort. And so no matter how high you climb, like you've got to remember that the people around you help empower you. Right. Mike Dunlap always said, like, when things fail, it's my fault. When things go well, I give credit to the people around me. Because when you're the head guy, when you're the big dog, it is what it is.
So I always go back to, again, reference this a couple times, not surprising for who the quality people we're talking to. I remember being a schlep dick intern at UConn and getting the message, hey, we're going to clean the Shankman, this brand new monolithic massive thing with all this stuff. And I remember being like, oh, yeah, we're going to clean it. Like, yeah, me. Walk in the door, and who's the first guy I see on his hands and knees cleaning the floor? Jerry Martin, director of strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Who else did I see? Every single person who was paid as a strength coach doing the same thing in addition to all the interns. And it was pretty clear if he was doing it, everybody else was too.
Yeah.
Lead from the front.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, so there's this great idea, this illustration that I have in my mind. Right. And it's this, this Egyptian block, right. And there's a rope in front of it and there's people pulling. Right. And so a boss is the guy standing on the block pointing in the direction that they're supposed to go. The leader is somebody who's in line with that rope, helping lead where that goes. And I think that's something that's really important that, you know, you have to make sure that you are leading and you're not a boss, because bosses get resented. Bosses have challenges that then come up, versus if you lead, your staff may come to you and say, hey, this is the problem I've got. How do we find a solution to it? Versus having something get bigger and a little bit more crazy than it needs to. Mm-hmm.
So that kind of rolls in, and you even said it yourself, invest in yourself. So that's our third question is, how does Pat Dixon sharpen his sword? Who is it, a brain trust? You know, do you have an executive team, a team of people? Do you have a particular person, or is it a combination of different things, reading books, going to stuff? So how do you sharpen your sword as a business person, as a coach, as a professional, as a person, whichever way you want to go, and then, you know, who, how, where, what?
Sure. So I think no matter what room you walk into, always be the least educated. And what I mean by that is your approach to that room is there's something to learn from everybody in that room. And if you walk into it thinking like, hey, I know everything, then all of a sudden your cup is already too full and you can't get anything else in it. So I think every situation you walk into, look at it from the standpoint of like, I can take a piece away from everybody in here. And whether that's being on time, whether that's how people sit in a chair or how they present themselves, whether that's how people ask questions, respond, talk down to. Like, there's always something to learn. I think the second thing is I always try to surround myself with people that are smarter than me. This morning, we ran the university, or not university, but the Olympic Park ski high jump stairs. And I didn't want to be up at 5:15 in the morning, but I knew there'd be some amazing people. And so I'm there with a senior vice president at one company, a CEO of another company, the ex-CFO of Backcountry. Like, and tremendous people, because they are humble, they are kind, and they are willing to have a conversation and share. But you've got to show up. You've got to make that effort yourself. And so I think the first thing is walking into every room and looking to learn something. And then the second piece really is surrounding yourself with smart people and not being afraid to not have anything to say. Sometimes you just got to listen. You know, it's okay to ask a question. It's okay to have opinions, but sometimes you should just kind of kick back and just listen and just kind of soak some stuff in, because you'd be surprised what silence allows you to hear from other people.
Well said. Well said. So I think with that, we're going to wrap this up, because that's usually we close with our big three questions. That was a great way to close it. Before we do go, anything else you want to add? Anything you want to plug? How do people find you? You know, how do they find the company? All that stuff.
Sure. So real simple. The company's at amphuman.com. You know, we're really about building products that are going to help people meaningfully. Science is everything for us. We're going to be launching a D-plus lotion in December that we've clinically shown could raise vitamin D levels in serum by 215% in 3 months and 236% in 4 months with daily use. It's a pea-sized amount of an aloe-based lotion that goes on your skin, and it's a really simple thing to add to your day, especially given around COVID. There are a lot of papers and research right now that are talking about influenza-type illnesses. And how there might be some correlation there. And I would think to the people that are listening to this, I've seen a little bit and I've done a little bit, just like everybody else has, right? And so everything that I've said here tonight is really about sharing my own experiences in hopes that maybe there's one or two snippets that you might take away from it that can add to your life. And I think understanding how challenging it can be to be a strength coach, to work some crazy hours, to manage that home life, to, you know, I'm in the process of gutting my house and rebuilding it. And so I'm excited about that. But it's really about making sure that you've got gratitude for every day, and that you show the people that are important to you appreciation so that they understand how much you mean to them. Because all too often we get caught up in this hustle and bustle, and we don't have the opportunity to really take a step back and just say thank you, or I care about you and I value you. And so those simple things go a very long way.
Nice. Well said. Well said. Pat, thank you very much again. I know we'll be in touch. We always exchange messages and whatnot often. And Powell, have a good night, man.